Welcome to AUSA's Army Matters podcast. I'm Carter Hamm, the president of AUSA, and I'll be your host. Our guest today is General John Hyten, vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the second highest ranking officer in our nation's armed forces. General Hyten is a native of Huntsville, Alabama, and in perhaps a foreshadowing of his Air Force career, he graduated from Grissom High School in Huntsville, the school named for Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Virgil Gus Grissom, one of the original Mercury 7 astronauts. General Hyten earned his bachelor's degree and his Air Force commission at Harvard University. He has commanded space units at the squadron, group, and wing levels, and he commanded U.S. Air Force Space Command before becoming the commander of United States Strategic Command, where he was responsible to the President and the Secretary of Defense for our nation's strategic nuclear forces. In November of 2019, he became just the 11th officer to serve as vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. General Hyten, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, General Hamm. It is good to hear your voice again.
I want to get to our main topic about joint operations in a moment, but before we go there, let's talk about the current pandemic. Among your many duties as vice chairman, you've been appointed co-chair, along with the Deputy Secretary of Defense, for DOD's COVID-19 Task Force. What would you say are the major lessons learned so far as DOD responds to this pandemic?
Well, there's a million lessons learned. We're going through a detailed in-stride review right now in the Joint Staff, with the COCOMs, with the services, and then ultimately with OSD and the interagency to figure out exactly how well we did, what we could do better, just like you do in any military operation. I think lesson number one is this is just a military operation like any other. You need a little bit different force structure to deal with this one. A lot of doctors, nurses, respiratory therapists, medical technicians, corpsmen, that's who you need to fight a problem like this. But I think once you get it in the hands of a combatant commander, assign the forces to the combatant commander, have the right roles and responsibilities, then actually things start to work pretty well. And that's what happened in this case. But we'll be looking at ourselves hard in the mirror to figure out what we did right, what we did wrong, what we can do better. If and when it ever happens again, we'll be even more prepared than we were this time.
You talked a bit about the heavy reliance on medical forces. Much of the DOD's response has come from the National Guard and from the reserve of the various services. Can we sustain that level of effort without adversely affecting readiness, recruiting, and importantly for the Guard and Reserve, employer support?
Well, General Hamm, I think that's something we always have to look at really hard. But that's what the National Guard is for. That's what the Reserve is for. You know, that's what the Guard motto is, always ready, always there. And they were, thank goodness, because most of our medical capacity is in the Guard and Reserve. So I think it was March the 27th when the president authorized us to mobilize the Guard and Reserve. That's the day when I started to breathe a little bit easier because I knew that we could tap into the amazing capacity that we have built in our reserve component. But we have to watch how it impacts readiness, how it impacts our ability to continue to recruit. Employer support will be an interesting dynamic because, you know, we have so many businesses that have stopped, so many people out of work right now. When they look at what the Guard has done in this area, what the reserve forces have done in this area, I think everybody's thankful for that. So I think we'll get a lot of support from employers as we come out of this. Next week sometime, I think roughly we're looking at the 6th of June, the medical forces in the Guard and Reserve will basically all be out of New York City, all out of Los Angeles, out of all the places that we deployed into, and they'll be out. The Guard will still be out in large numbers through the summer, but the medical forces were pulling back. I think that we'll come out of this in good shape, but it's something that we have to watch really close.
Well, I got to tell you, as a very interested observer and as a veteran, watching how the Department of Defense has responded to the COVID-19 pandemic, it's been very rewarding to see how well America's service women and men have responded in this crisis. You mentioned, again, the medical folks over the past couple of years, some of which has been driven through legislation and the National Defense Authorization Act. Lots of discussion about changes in the size and organization of military medicine. Has the pandemic and DOD's response to the pandemic resulted in how the department is thinking about those changes now?
So it's caused me to question a lot of things about how we're structured. We have so much in the Guard and Reserve. We depend so highly on our civilian capacity in order to deal with any large breakouts. This is one of the things we're going to look hard in this in-stride review that the chairman has initiated and the Secretary of Defense wants to look at from a lessons learned perspective. We're going to take a fresh look at everything that we've done. We'll have to work with Congress, obviously. We'll have to work with the department and others to make sure we're structured correctly. But we really did focus on how we operate in peacetime. And what the pandemic was basically was a very significant medical stressful situation on our wartime capabilities. I don't want to make any assessments why we're still in the middle of it, because you're always a little too close to it at that point. But it's something that we'll look hard at right now, we'll continue to look hard at, and we'll propose adjustments if we see things that we need to adjust as we go through it. You know, we put a halt on the transition from moving medical treatment facilities from the services to the Defense Health Agency as we've gone through this, because we didn't want to have that dynamic change as we go through this. We'll have to look at that as we come out to see if we want to start that up again, how we want to go through. But this is something we'll take a hard look at in our in-stride review. Over.
Good. Well, thanks very much for that, Vice Chairman. That's very insightful. One last question about COVID-19. And you mentioned some of this in your opening comments. There's been much made about a second wave of COVID-19, a so-called boomerang effect. How prepared is the U.S. military for such an eventuality?
We had a good pandemic plan that's been around since 2013 as we started into this. But as you'll understand, no plan survives first contact with the enemy, and this one didn't either. So we're going to have to go back and adjust our plans. But I can tell you right now, we're more ready now than we were in February. We're more ready now than we were in April. We understand the disease a whole lot better, and it is a very, very complicated disease. It is going to be an interesting fall, because there's going to be something come back, but I don't think it's going to be nearly as big, because I think the country understands it better. I think we understand social distancing. We understand how to test, how to do contact tracing, how to do those kind of things. So I don't think we're going to see the massive problem we had in the spring, but we have to be ready for anything. And I think the military is going to be ready for whatever the fall brings us. I don't think it's going to be nearly as bad as the spring. Nonetheless, we still have to be ready.
No, thanks for that. Again, watching the military response to the pandemic, it has really been reassuring. The professionalism, the expertise, the commitment, and indeed the courage of servicemen and women across the nation responding to this pandemic. It's been really a good thing to see.
Yeah, just one thing, since this is the Association of the United States Army, a couple of amazing stories from the Army perspective is the Army, when we activated the Guard and Reserve, created out of whole cloth these Army Reserve Urban Augmentation Task Forces, things that didn't exist before. Doctors, nurses, that we could just drop in on a location, and they could fall in on one of the centers that the Corps of Engineers built. They could fall in on an existing hospital. They could set up a structure by themselves. They created 15 of these task forces out of whole cloth, basically the weekend after the mobilization. And that was a huge success story. Look at what the Corps of Engineers did in terms of building. Thank goodness we did not use that capacity, but the capacity was there if we needed it. What the Corps did, what the task forces did, the medical task forces were remarkable. So just kudos to the Army for figuring that stuff out early on. I just wanted to squeeze that in, since this is the Association of the United States Army.
Yes, we are, and we are obviously very, very proud of all those soldiers who responded across the joint force. And that really is our principal topic for today, is the joint force. And we'd like to talk with you a bit about how our military is preparing to operate now and into the future. The National Defense Strategy of 2018 quite clearly describes the environment in which American armed forces will operate. That's driven a considerable level of effort in developing the right operating concepts, as well as modernization strategies, some innovative ideas about personnel programs and institutional reform. The services, of course, have been hard at work developing their own operating concepts. Our Army listeners will be quite familiar with the Army's multi-domain operations as an evolving concept. But the National Defense Strategy describes and current operations demonstrate that military operations are inherently joint and usually multinational. How's the joint staff coordinating or leading the services efforts to achieve the best outcome, developing a joint operating concept, if you will?
That's a really important challenge that we face as a joint force, because when you look at the department, the people that build stuff is not the joint staff. It's not even OSD. The people that build stuff for the services, the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Space Force now, They're the ones that build the stuff. And so we, as the joint staff and we as the joint force, have to figure out how to create a structure whereby the services can build systems that will interoperate. That's the easy thing to say. But more importantly, leverage the unique capabilities that each services bring to bear, operate seamlessly against the threat environment, and deliver overwhelming capabilities in any future fight. That's what we're trying to do. So we have an element in the Joint Staff J7 that does Joint Force Development Design. And the structure that we put together, with big support from the services as well as OSD, is something called the Joint Warfighting Concept. And we're going to deliver that Joint Warfighting Concept at the end of this year. Now, COVID has put a little bit of challenge into that because we were going to use a lot of war games, a lot of exercises, a lot of different things that requires a lot of people working together. So we're having to adjust. How do we get through that? We think we've come up with a good plan to still deliver it by the end of the year. But in that joint warfighting concept will be how the joint force needs to fight in the future. And underneath that, interestingly, there are four supporting concepts: all domain command and control, logistics, fires, information advantage. We have to figure out how to do all those together in whatever the warfighting concept is. So we're starting down that path. And so we're going to use all of the elements the joint staff can bring to bear, one of them which is one I chair, the JROC, the Joint Requirements Oversight Committee. And we're going to have requirements documents that are a little bit different than the normal requirements documents. These won't be system specifications. They won't detail exactly what the services have to build. But when we define logistics and we define command and control and joint fires and information advantage, we're going to describe the capabilities and attributes that have to be delivered, and then we're going to monitor through the joint staff how the services build capabilities to do that. That's going to be a different way of doing business, because that's what we have to do in order to stay ahead of our adversaries. We have to be able to pull that in. Like you said, the Army started down that road with multi-domain ops, the Air Force with multi-domain command and control. Each of the services started down that path. Now we've got to pull them all together and deliver that globally integrated, partnered, joint combined force that can outthink, outmaneuver, outfight any adversary as we go into the future. So that's a long answer, but it was a long question too. So this is going to be a challenge, but this is what I really look forward to doing this year, if we can just carve out enough time from the COVID challenge to really get after it, because this is the important issue for our nation and our military as we go forward.
I think that's right. The joint operating concept is foundational to everything else that will be required of the joint force. We applaud your efforts. It's a massive undertaking. As one component of that, how are you including allies and other trusted partners in this effort to develop a new operating concept?
So a number of different ways. First of all, we have some very close allies, commonly referred to as the Five Eyes partners, that we're involving right from the beginning in what these concepts look like. So they can be part of understanding, again, the capabilities and attributes that we're going to bring to bear in a future fight, because those are the same capability attributes that they're going to have to hook into. Then we have to leverage the capabilities of other countries. So we have about, I think, 20 foreign liaison officers that are assigned to J7 down in Suffolk, the old Joint Forces Command structure that's now under the Joint Staff, to help us in defining this concept development, experimentation, and what the joint warfighting concept is going to be. And then as we go forward in this joint warfighting concept this summer, right now in August, we're going to have a big tabletop exercise now involving the allies and partners to kind of do a deep dive into that concept and make sure we're hitting all of the critical elements that need to be brought to bear for a combined approach and the required capabilities that we're going to expect from our partners. So it's a big challenge, made a little bit more difficult by the COVID environment, but that August tabletop exercise will be a big test to make sure we got it right.
Well, clearly outlined in the National Defense Strategy is the necessity for American armed forces to work closely with allies and partners. So that's reassuring, actually, the effort that you and the joint staff are undertaking. You know, operationalizing a new concept will undoubtedly require new types of organizations and significantly modernized capabilities. Perhaps in our current time, the Space Force is the most significant evident type of structural change. Do you have any insights yet as to what other significant organizational changes may be required?
You know, it's an interesting question, since I've been so involved in the Space Force, the Space Command structure, the Cyber Command structure over the last few years. in many cases, we like to believe that organizational issues solve all our problems. And in many cases, organizational issues are required to solve some of our problems. I think the Space Force is going to help us as we go into that. But the real issue that you see in all the things I just described, and what will continue to drive change in our organization and structure as we go forward, is this global nature that's embedded in all those things I just described. What is the unique thing about space and the Space Force and the Space Command? It's a global capability that impacts all areas of operation, impacts all theaters. What does cyber do? Same thing. SOCOM is a global capability. All of these global capabilities have to be brought to bear effectively as we go forward. So you're going to see kind of a refocus from purely regional focused to a more global focused. Now, that doesn't mean that the regional commands go away, because you still have to build the allies and partners. And you don't do allies and partners from space. You don't do allies and partners from cyber. You do the allies and partners by knocking on somebody's door and building relationships and that kind of structure. So that structure is going to be around for a long time. But when we think about how we operate and how we fight, it's going to be a much more global perspective. And then you're going to see changes, maybe organizational changes, in how we acquire stuff, buy stuff, do things differently, because we have to figure out how to move faster. The structure that we've had over the last, well, most of my career, where it takes 5 years to figure out what you want to buy, then 10 years to build it, and then you have it for another 30 years, that's not the world we're going to live in. The world we're going to live in is going to require immediate deliveries of new software. It's going to use AI to adjust on the fly. Fighting an electromagnetic spectrum fight is going to be critical as we go forward. Data becomes the key to everything. And right now, we're in many cases still using an industrial age model for how we buy and support things. We've got to move into a 21st century model on how to do that. So we're going to be making changes, I think probably some organizational changes, to make sure that we can go fast enough to stay ahead of our adversaries. Because our adversaries in this case are going very, very fast. And the model I described to you of 20, 25 year timelines, that just will not hack it into the future.
Well, you and the chairman, DepSecDef, and Secretary Esper have talked a lot about the necessity for institutional reform in this regard, and we all look forward to seeing what those changes are, but I think you're exactly right. Being much more agile, much more responsive, much faster in our institutional processes will be a necessary requirement as we're moving forward. Of course, all that costs money. Lots of debate about what's going to happen to defense budgets and spending. What's the impact of the spending on COVID-related matters? But how confident are you that the department will have the resourcing necessary to build the future force that a new operating concept will require?
So I think it was General Mattis used to say that America can afford survival. So I always believe that we can, and we always will figure out how to do that. Now, the budget is going to come under enormous pressure as we look forward in a few years. If you look at how much money we've spent in the last 2 months because of COVID, we've spent trillions of dollars that is added to our deficit. So there's going to be huge pressure, which means even though we probably, if you look at our current plan, we probably need, in order to maintain the modernization program and everything else we got going, you probably have to have like a 3-5% real budget increases over the next few years. I think that's a false hope. I think at best it's going to be flat. It's likely to even come down a little bit. But all that means is that we have to make sure we prioritize correctly. And I think that when you look at our structure, the thing you have to look at is our position in the world right now is a position of advantage. We have advantage in size, capacity, capability over any adversary we face in the world. So what that tells me is that it's possible that we can take some near-term risk to make sure that we still have that advantage in the out years. So we're going to have to figure out how to modernize to a more lethal force, how to continue to build our alliances. We're going to have to reform the department in order to do that. We got to make sure we take care of our people. That's probably the most important thing we have to do, because we're nothing without our people. Without soldiers, sailors, and airmen, Marines, this military is nothing. And so that means that we probably won't be able to afford to sustain a number of the legacy, outdated capabilities that we have in the long term, because we're going to have to take that money and put it towards modernization. And that becomes a very challenging issue with our board of directors, the 535 members of Congress across the street, because that is a change in kind of how we do business. But if we come under budget pressures, we have to be able to make the hard decisions, and we have to be able to prioritize. And we have to be honest when we look ourselves in the mirror every day about what the most important things are to us. We have to defend this nation. We have to deter our adversaries. And if called upon, we have to fight and win our nation's wars. That takes equipment, but it also takes the best people in the world, which is what we have today. We just have to make sure we have that 10 years from now.
Yeah, these are incredible challenges. And it seems, at least to me, in my time in service, I don't think there's been a time that I can recall that so many modernization efforts, significant modernization efforts, occur across the joint force simultaneously. So modernizing the strategic force, expanding artificial intelligence, space, and cyber capabilities, growing the Navy, and selfishly for us at AUSA, a particular interest in modernizing the total Army, all of which entail risk that you've identified. When you're together with the chairman and the service chiefs, how do you think about those risks? What are the factors that you consider?
First thing I think about when I look at risk is who is assuming the risk. That's always been an interesting dynamic for me. So when I think about risk for the soldiers in the crowd, every soldier that has been deployed the last 20 years has been given the authority and responsibility to manage risk on the battlefield. In fact, down to small unit levels led by NCOs or very junior officers, they have the authority under certain rules of engagement to employ lethal force if required. And we understand that. We understand that risk equation, and we naturally understand that risk equation. But it's interesting when you think about taking risk in these global capabilities, cyber, space, many of those authorities are held at the highest levels, deciding what to buy, deciding what is the next thing to buy. Those things are pulled back. In many cases, we don't allow ourselves to take the risk. In many cases, those risks have been assumed by committees in the Pentagon because the risks are too difficult for any one individual. I would postulate that the requirement to use lethal force is a more demanding requirement than the decision to buy the next tank, artillery piece, satellite, missile, whatever it is. But somehow we take that risk authority away from commanders and leaders and put them in committees. So to me, when I think about risk, it's about who is assuming the risk. And I think that we can make the right risk decisions. And the risk decisions come down to, do we have the right capabilities in the right place at the right time to do something? Are we going fast enough? We have to take sometimes of acquisition risk instead of operational risk. But it's funny to me that acquisition risk is removed from the operational force, whereas operational risk is not. And acquisition risk, to me, is a lesser risk than it is on the operational side. So I think we need to understand innovation, investment, risk of moving fast, risk of making mistakes. We have to allow our people to make mistakes sometimes and learn from those mistakes and move fast. We have to understand that we may have a failure here and there as we go down that path. That's okay as long as we learn and we move forward. I think we've just missed over the last 20 years teaching our entire force, not just the operational force, but our entire force, how to take prudent risk. And that means understanding the good things that can happen out of a decision, the bad things that can happen out of a decision, looking at different courses of action and making the best decision based on the information you have right now, and not waiting for perfect information. Because if you wait for perfect information, you're going to be wholly disappointed and you'll wait forever. But I swear, on some of these program decisions that we're making, we're looking for the perfect information and it's just not going to be there. We have to assume risk. And when we make these program decisions, we're going to assume more risk in the near term so we don't have to take risk in the far term. I don't want a future commander in the field to ever have to go into a fair fight. Because if we've done that, then we have failed a future soldier. Thanks for the question.
Well, your passion is appreciated and I think particularly well-founded. It also underscores your emphasis on having the right people because ultimately that's what the force requires. You can have all the best equipment, best concept. If we don't have the right people, we have real challenges. I would also tell you, just as an old soldier, hearing you talk about risk, knowing that your voice in that regard is heard at the highest levels of government when evaluating risk, that gives me confidence, and it ought to be very reassuring to all of our listeners that your passion, your concern, the depth of your experience is at those highest levels. So thanks for that. As we come to the end of our time, no matter how we look at it, you've got a lot on your plate as Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. What can we as individual citizens and we as military service organizations, what can we do to help you in this effort?
Well, actually, you talked about it a few minutes ago, General Hamm, and that is our people are our greatest asset. We have to take care of our people. It's so easy to get wrapped around the amazing things that we get to operate. I've been lucky enough to be at the beginning of GPS and watch GPS go from nothing to everything. I've watched rockets, missiles, nuclear capabilities. The things I've seen, it's amazing. But the most amazing thing I've seen by far is our people. And the thing that AUSA and all the military service organizations, I think your first focus has got to be making sure we're always doing everything we can to take care of our people. Because if we make a mistake there, that's a mistake that is very, very difficult to recover from. If we have a little mistake in an acquisition program or something like that, we can recover from that. We may have wasted some taxpayer money, and that's a horrible thing. But if we lose the people that want to raise their right hand and come into the military, and they don't want to do that anymore, then we will not have the greatest military in the world. So one of my roles is to give military advice to the president, the secretary of defense, support the chairman every way I can. I have this job on the joint staff to figure out how we move faster. That's my second priority. But a big priority of mine is to make sure we take care of people. And I hired a special assistant just to make sure that she always reminds me not to forget about the people, because it's so easy when you work in the Pentagon to forget about the people that are doing the real work. You know, I had my son a long time ago look at me over the dinner table one time, and I was a 2-star. He said, "Dad, I've been watching you ever since you made general. And I finally realized something." I said, "What's that?" And he said, "You don't do any real work anymore." And he said, "You know, he's absolutely right. I don't do the real work. The soldiers, sailors, airmen, marine in this amazing military that we have, they do all the work. And so we have got to take care of them. Now, we need advocacy. We need education. The modernization programs we have to be supported. And AUSA and organizations like them can support that. But by far, the most important thing we need is to continue to support our people and our veterans and everybody that has served and is serving. So thanks to AUSA for what you do. Thanks to all the organizations like AUSA for what you do. But I just encourage you to keep doing that. I appreciate it.
General John Hyten, 11th Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, thank you not just for your insights offered today, but more so for your lifetime of service to our nation. You and your family have truly made a difference. Thank you, sir, for being with us today.
To all our listeners, thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere podcasts are found. Join us next Monday with a brand new episode of Army Matters with Army Real Talk. The Army Matters podcast series is brought to you by the Association of the United States Army, the U.S. Army's professional association, member-supported, Army-connected. Visit us at AUSA.org for more information or to become a member. Your membership helps AUSA continue to carry out its mission to educate, inform, and connect with the total Army, our industry partners, and our supporters of a strong national defense. For questions or to provide topic recommendations, email us at podcast@AUSA.org. Have a great Army Day. Hooah.